Well, good evening. This is going to be the last in the series of lessons that we've been doing on Sunday nights, looking at different aspects of creation, whether it's different places or different created things, and seeing the way that they're described and talked about in the Bible. And one of the goals of this is that all of the things we've talked about, we see very regularly, whether you're talking about the sky, or you're talking about mountains, or you're talking about the body, or you're talking about animals, or even other things maybe we don't see as much, but like the wilderness or the desert area, gardens, we see regularly. But each of these things you'll see throughout your life. And what I think is valuable, and when I'm intentional about this, I can often look throughout my day and see things and be reminded of the goodness of God. But when I'm not thinking about it, I can see all those exact same things and just be thinking about the fact that I'm in a hurry, or be thinking about, you know, something that's not, doesn't really matter much at all. And I think it is helpful to be reminded day after day after day, even when we put our Bibles down and we're driving in the car, or when we're having a conversation with someone, that all around us there are these proofs of the goodness of God. There are these demonstrations of the beauty and artistry of God. There are all of these signposts that there is something greater than us. And I hope that as we go throughout our lives, we'll see those things. And we'll be reminded of it day after day after day, that God's goodness is all around us. I love the language of Romans chapter 1. Where Paul says that even his invisible attributes are clearly seen, being understood of the things which he made. God is invisible, but that doesn't mean there's no visible pointers to God. They are all around us. And so that was one of the purposes of this series of lessons. And also, you know, different, as we read the Bible and you come across different settings and different things that are discussed, whether it's the children of Israel in the wilderness, you should immediately, upon hearing in the wilderness, have some different feelings conjured up than if you heard in the garden. You know, garden is a different image in the Bible. It means something different. And you should, the more aware we are of those types of differences, I think it helps us become better readers of the text and understand what's going on there a little bit more. And so with all of that being said, we're going to talk about the last place here tonight that we're going to discuss. And it's a place that is very common in the Bible. We've talked about water, we've talked about mountains, we've talked about the skies, we've talked about the wilderness, we've talked about rivers and lakes, we've talked about all these different places. Well, here's a place that the place is important, but then also what comes from the place is important, and that is the vineyard. The vineyard is a key setting in the Bible, not so much because there are a bunch of stories in the vineyard, but there is a lot that is made of the vine, of the grape, of the juice that comes from a grape. In fact, that's a very vivid image for God's blessing for his people. Sometimes it's an image of God's wrath towards his people. It's often an image of the messianic age. Jesus uses that imagery a lot. It's no accident, I don't think, that one of the very few aspects of physical creation that we need for worship comes from a grape. When we have the Lord's Supper, I mean, there's not a ton else that we actually need. We need our bodies, we need unleavened bread, and you need a grape, or the juice that comes from a grape. But you think of all the things that God created, that means there's something significant there. There's something significant about the grape. Again, I don't think that it's any accident that that's actually central to some of what we do in our Christian worship. Before I get much further, though, I do want to be clear on something. This is not a lesson on the appropriate or inappropriate use of alcohol. This isn't a lesson. I'm going to be talking about grapes. I'm going to be talking about some wine, some texts in the Bible that talk about that. I am in no way, the purpose of this lesson is not for us to come away thinking, oh, that's a sin, or oh, that's okay. The varying amounts or whatever level of alcohol there might or might not be in any of these texts is not the purpose of the lesson. The grape is the purpose of the lesson, the juice that comes from the grape. That other topic is a lesson for a different day, and I think it's an interesting topic and all that. But this is about the vineyard, about the vine, about the grape, and about the juice, not about whether or not alcohol is something Christians should be dabbling in. But when you talk about those topics, the grape, the vineyard, the juice that comes from it, these are often symbols of blessings for God's people. Again, there's a reason why in the Gospel of John, the very first sign that Jesus does is the sign of turning water into wine and saving the wedding feast. And that is something that I think when read against the backdrop of Old Testament language about wine, it is seen as something that is a sign of the Messianic age. And Jesus introduces his ministry with that imagery. And then again, I don't think it's any coincidence that the last I am statement in the Gospel of John. So the Gospel of John, beautifully structured. It has, traditionally we count them as seven signs that Jesus does. And then there are the seven I am statements where he describes, there are a couple of I am statements where it's just I am. Like before Abraham was, I am. Or except ye believe that I am, you will die in your sins. Or when Jesus is about to be arrested in Gethsemane, he says, I am, and the Roman soldiers fall down. So there are those type of just direct, emphatic I am statements. But then there are these other descriptive I am statements. I am the good shepherd, or I am the door, or I am the way, the truth, and the life. I am the resurrection and the life. I am the bread that comes down out of heaven. Like, there are all these other statements that convey different ideas about his identity. Well, the first sign he does is water into wine, and the last I am statement is, I am the true vine. And we're going to talk about that passage as we bring the lesson to a close, but he actually says some really foundational things about how we ought to think about him and our relationship to him, and he relates it to the idea of a vine that has branches growing off of it and grapes that are being produced, and how all of that is a reminder of the life that we have through Christ. And God is the one, the Father is the vine dresser who keeps it all trimmed and healthy and all of that, and it connects to the idea that what happens to a grape when you take it off of the vine? Well, it doesn't last super long, right? In order for it to thrive and to live, it needs to be connected to the vine. And so even the imagery of how essential Jesus is to life connects to the vine. But all of that is a way of saying that this is a subject that has deep Old Testament roots and is used for a lot of imagery in the New Testament as well. Passover and the Lord's Supper both contain the fruit of the vine, and this is something, again, that goes all the way back to the beginning. So, back in Genesis, we're introduced to a vineyard fairly early on. Interestingly, though, not explicitly in Eden. I'm sure there were grapes in Eden. I'd be shocked if there weren't grapes in Eden, but they're not mentioned in Eden. Grapes are not mentioned until you get to Noah after the flood. What you end up getting are two very parallel stories. And as we'll see here in a second, there's a third parallel story that's kind of different. But in the Garden of Eden, you have this tree that's producing the fruit of the knowledge of good and evil. And Adam and Eve misuse the tree. They eat the one that they're not supposed to eat from. And then they end up naked and ashamed, right? And they bring sin into this world. And by bringing sin into this world, you keep reading, and just chaos follows. And sin multiplies. It gets way worse than you ever thought. I mean, eating a fruit seems relatively harmless, but pretty soon you have a brother murdering another brother. Pretty soon you have a guy named Lamech who's taking multiple wives, kills a young boy for insulting him, and eventually gets to the point where it says, every thought of the intentions of the hearts of man were only evil continually. That's a bad state for the world to be in. It's a reminder, by the way, that sometimes the thing that seems so innocent, when it goes against the will and word of God, can lead to some really dangerous places you never thought you'd end up going. Well, that's the state that the world was in. And so then you get what's called the flood. And that is a way of cleansing the world, starting things over. It cleanses it of all of that evil that had run amok. And we're left with a family, Noah and his family, right after the flood. And you think, okay, now we're back to a world that is, in essence, you know, sinless. We haven't had a sin in the world yet. And we haven't, you know, so how are things going to go now? Are we going to have a better future now? Well, Genesis chapter 9, I want you to turn there with me quickly. Genesis chapter 9, this is right after Noah gets off the boat. God ends up describing this covenant with him. We talked about this covenant last time. It's a covenant that God makes with Noah, with his family, with all of his family after him, and then also with the earth itself and with the animals. So it's a pretty universal covenant that God makes. But then notice the first thing that Noah does after the sign of the covenant. You can look, and this is verse 17. And God said to Noah, "This is the sign of the covenant, which I have established between me and all the flesh that is on the earth." And then it describes his sons coming out of the ark, and then it says in verse 20, "Then Noah began farming and planted a vineyard." Okay, that's a good verse. Nothing bad so far. He began farming, he planted a vineyard. Kind of, you know, like Adam was in a garden, now Noah's in a vineyard. You know, the first person of the initial creation was Adam. Noah's like the first person, along with his family, of the creation after the flood, right? How are things going to go? Well, remember, Adam misused God's creation. He did what he wasn't supposed to do. He ended up naked. And then he and his wife and the earth were cursed because of that, right? Well, what happens immediately is Noah ends up farming and planting a vineyard, and he drank of the wine and became drunk and uncovered himself inside his tent. And so immediately what you have happen is planting, misusing the produce, being naked, and then being ashamed of that. As what ends up happening is he has a son, Ham, who ends up, there's a lot of discussion about what exactly happens here that we're not going to get into, but Ham handles this situation irresponsibly, whereas Shem and Japheth, they go and they respectfully cover up their father. And so immediately after this, you end up having curse and blessing introduced into the new world after the flood. Notice verse 25. "Cursed be Canaan, the servant of servants, he shall be to his brothers." And so again, just like after Adam, you have the curses. After Noah's sin, you have the curses. But all of that is to say, the first sin started in a garden. Well, a garden's not a bad thing. We already talked about the garden. The garden's a wonderful place in the Bible. The garden is often a picture of very good things. And yet, it can be misused to bring about some pretty bad evil. Now we have a vineyard. And I think, as we'll see, as you read through, the vineyard's a good place also. God promises good, bountiful, plentiful vineyards to his people. The vineyard is supposed to be something that brings blessing to God's people. In the promised land, the vineyard is a good sign of the health of the Israelites. When things are going well, the vineyard is productive. When God's going to punish the people, the vineyard dries up and the grapes dry up. That's pretty common imagery for life in Israel and in the promised land. But the vineyard, while it is a blessing, it can be misused also. The first story we have about a vineyard is of it being misused and leading to more sin entering into the world almost immediately after God just cleansed the world of sin. I mean, it's like when your kid goes out and he plays in the mud and you bring him inside and you get him bathed and they're all clean and you're thinking, all right, this is great. And then you turn your head and you look at him, there's like ketchup all over him again. You're like, I just cleaned you. You know, how are you a mess again? Well, that's what happened with the world after the flood of Noah. And you see that the vineyard is where, so it started, the first place was the garden, the second place was the vineyard. The third mention of wine in the Bible, this is the first mention of it. The third mention of it is also a pretty nasty scene. It is, so think about Noah. The world was just destroyed in a judgment by God. All right. In the days of Lot, he was living in a city called Sodom, and there were a couple of cities around it that were really, really wicked also, and God was going to destroy Sodom and Gomorrah. And yet, instead of destroying everything, he saved Noah and his family. Instead of destroying all of the city, he saved Lot and his family. And he let Lot leave the city of Sodom and Gomorrah, and he was able to find refuge elsewhere. His children, who he brought with him, remember how Noah was naked in the tent, and his son went in there and uncovered his father's nakedness. He perhaps saw something you shouldn't see or did something you shouldn't see, and he was cursed because of it. And his father was drunk in that whole ordeal. Okay, we'll go fast forward to Lot. You have him having just left Sodom, and so like major destruction, divine judgment from God, just like Noah had endured. He's in a tent. He's with his children. He's with his daughters. And they get him drunk. And then his two daughters, in two different nights, they end up sleeping with him. And they end up getting pregnant from their father. And then they end up having these two children, Moab and Ammon, who are the neighbors of Israel. And so because of that, it's a really twisted and kind of gross story. Sorry to bring it up, but it's in there. But because of that, like the children of Israel, whenever they see a Moabite or an Ammonite, that's the origin story of these people. And it's like immediate, it's kind of stomach turning. And so, by the way, that's an important thing to know when you read, say, the book of Ruth. And Ruth is a Moabite. She's immediately going to be viewed as with some skepticism here. You know, that's who her people are. When they get to the plains of Moab in the book of Numbers before entering the Promised Land, things don't go well. They end up worshiping the gods of the Moabites and sleeping with the Moabite women. Like, they don't have a good righteous history with the Moabites. Well, it all starts right there. But notice how the similarities in those stories kind of leap off the page with Noah and his children, Lot and his children, alcohol in a tent, sexual immorality. Like, all of that stuff is kind of in both of those stories. Well, I'll say vineyards aren't off to a good start in the story of the Bible up to this point. There is, however, a reference in the middle of those, and it doesn't really say too much about it. It's just one brief reference to wine, and it is with Melchizedek. When Abraham is returning from the battle and he meets Melchizedek, the priest of God Most High, and Melchizedek greets him with bread and with wine. And then he blesses Abram, and Abram returns a tenth portion to Melchizedek. But you have this early story right there where the priest of God has the bread and the wine. And by the way, bread and wine is kind of an important biblical image. That's something that we'll see throughout the Bible, and that's something, again, with the Lord's Supper that we just had this morning. That's something that type of image stays with us in the Bible. But you see it began all the way back with Melchizedek in Genesis chapter 14. So what does all of this say? Well, I think off the bat, you get the idea that there are some dangers associated with the misuse of the vineyard and the misuse of the grape and the misuse of the juice or the wine that comes from it. However, there also seem to be a lot of some positive things associated with it as you continue the story. You see it with Melchizedek, you know, bringing it. But then when you look at the worship of Israel, grapes and the fruit of the vine was an essential part of worship in Israel. There were drink offerings that were poured out and were offered up to God as part of worship. That was something that was central to Israelite worship. When you read through the book of Deuteronomy, you see repeated ideas of God's blessing for his people being seen and how the land produces. And one of the key images is the production of grapes and vines and new wine. And so that's, again, something that is a blessing to the people. Yet, the curses that are mentioned by God when the children of Israel become disobedient to God, one of the curses that's often seen is that the grape and the vine, they dry up and they wither. And so they are no longer productive. Look with me. We'll just look at just a quick example of God's blessing. Look at Deuteronomy chapter 7. Deuteronomy mentions it quite a bit. You could just do look up the word grape or the word wine in the Bible, and you'll see that it's mentioned a good number of times in Deuteronomy. And you can look up vineyard and vine also, and you'll see this pattern of Israelites good, they have good wine. Israelites bad, the grape withers up and they don't. But if you look at Deuteronomy chapter 7 in verse 12, says, then it shall come about, because you listen to these judgments and keep and do them, that the Lord your God will keep with you his covenant and his loving kindness, which he swore to your fathers. He will love you and bless you and multiply you. He will also bless the fruit of your womb and the fruit of your ground, your grain and your new wine and your oil, the increase of your herd, of the young and of your flock in the land which he swore to your forefathers to give you. So there is a blessing for the people, and you can see it in the family, you can see it in their animals, you can see it in the land, in the production of grain, and with wine. You can see that in their worship, they bring wine offerings to God. They, if they're unable to for like their tithes. If they're unable to travel with their animals a long distance, they can sell them and use the money and purchase wine and celebrate before the Lord. That's in Deuteronomy chapter 14. If you look at Deuteronomy chapter 33, Deuteronomy chapter 33, there's this description of Israel. Deuteronomy 33:28. It says, so Israel dwells in security, the fountain of Jacob secluded, in a land of grain and new wine. His heavens also drip down dew. Blessed are you, O Israel. These are like some of the last words of Moses that we have, and their blessings upon the land in Israel. And what is the blessing on the land like? You're a land of grain and wine. You're a land where you'll be able to make bread and have wine and grapes. And so that's just, it's common blessing language in the Torah. And that continues, by the way, into the prophets as well. There are a number of things that I think are interesting when talking about the promised land. Remember in Numbers 13 and 14, they send the spies to go check out the land. And they send 12 spies, and two of them come back, Joshua and Caleb, saying, hey, the land is amazing. Let's go take it because God said it's ours. And the other 10 spies say, yeah, the land is amazing, but there's no way we could possibly take it. The people are huge. They have fortified cities. We're like grasshoppers in their sight. And I think they forgot the purpose of their trip. The purpose of their trip wasn't to determine whether or not they should take the land. God had already told them to do that. They weren't supposed to be judging whether or not this battle was a good idea. They were supposed to be seeing the land and telling the people about it. But instead, they end up coming back and saying, we shouldn't go for it. God brought us out here just to die. It'd be better if we went back to Egypt. But what made the land so great? What are some of the images that describe it? Well, land flowing with milk and honey. That's a common one. That's one that we think of as an odd combination. But hey, I bet it was good. But one of the images they use is they cut off like one cluster of grapes from the vine, and it took two men holding a pole to carry that huge cluster of grapes back. That's how productive and fruitful the land is. So like when they're coming up, what image describes how good a land is? They go to grapes pretty quickly. Tons of grapes there, heavy grapes, thick grapes, healthy grapes. And so again, all of this is to say that the land, that God's blessing is often symbolized by the production of vineyards. The Sabbath, vineyards had a Sabbath just like the rest of the land did, but you were supposed to not, every seventh year, you let the vineyards rest. You're supposed to share the produce of your vineyards. Look with me, two passages. One of them is Leviticus 19. Leviticus 19, verse 10, talking about not gleaning everything from your fields, it says, nor shall you glean your vineyard, nor shall you gather the fallen fruit of your vineyard. You shall leave them for the needy and for the stranger. I am the Lord your God. And so if you have a nice productive vineyard, you're not supposed to gather everything that's in it. And if something drops, leave it there, because there are some foreigners in your land and there are people in your land who maybe their vineyards weren't as productive. So you're supposed to share the produce of it. Not only do you share it in that context, by the way, if you keep reading, this is the chapter that says you shall love your neighbor as yourself. This is one of the ways that you do that, is by not keeping everything in your vineyard and in your field for yourself. But if you look at Deuteronomy chapter 23 and verse 24, this is again about sharing the produce of the vineyard. But Deuteronomy 23:24 says, when you enter your neighbor's vineyard, then you may eat grapes until you are fully satisfied, but you shall not put any of it in your basket. So basically, if you're walking through your friend's yard or your neighbor's yard, whatever you can fit in your hands, that's yours. He's sharing his grapes with you. That's part of being an Israelite, is you share. Now, don't go take like a basket in there and fill it up. Now you're just getting carried away. But, you know, as you walk through, you can pluck and you can eat. That's part of the sharing. That's a natural part of the land. One of the things that's interesting, if you were to count up all of the passages about liquid in the Bible, do you know what the most common liquid is? water, which yeah, I bet you could guess that one. But number two, it's the liquid that comes from a grape. It's the juice that comes from a grape. And when it in passages about drinking, water isn't even number one. It is the grape. Like, so the grape is something that is, again, a very common image in the Bible for God's blessing, for the children of Israel, what they, like, what a good drink would be with a good meal. And so, again, that's a pretty common image, but again, it can be misused. In 1 Kings 21, you have a king who notices a really good, nice vineyard there in his land, owned by a Jezreelite named Naboth. And what he and his wife do is they end up killing him to take the vineyard. So you have some really bad vineyard stories and grape stories, whether you're talking about Noah, Ahab the king, Lot, but then you also have it as this promise of divine favor for God's people. Look at just four passages about enjoying life. The grape pops up. Look at Ecclesiastes chapter 9. Ecclesiastes chapter 9 and verse 7. You know, Ecclesiastes is a profound and really thought-provoking book. Some of it can be kind of troubling as you read through it. Some of it can be really encouraging. And some of it, it's like every good thing that you think there is, the more you investigate it, the more you find out that it's just folly and you can't actually put your hope in what seems like that good thing, whether it's you know, productivity in your work, whether it's gaining wisdom, or whether it's wealth, or whether it's pleasure. Like, all of these things, if you try to make them the central focus of your life, you come to find out that they don't last. And there's so much random chaos in this world that the thing that you thought you were doing that would lead to that often won't lead to that. And even if you get it, you only have it for a moment. And so the word that he uses over and over again is just, it's a vapor, it's a mist, it's vanity. It's something that seems like it's there, but you can't actually grab a hold of it. So what can you do? Well, by the time you get to the end of Ecclesiastes, I think one of those things you do is you fear the Lord, you obey him, because that is something that actually can endure. But then also throughout the book, he stops and he says, and also, when you do have something good, enjoy it. Enjoy it right now. You're allowed to do that. Like, you know, you might not be able to predict tomorrow, but if you can have a meal with loved ones and your family, then do that and enjoy it. I think this is one of those moments, you know, kind of a seize the day type of moment. This is Ecclesiastes 9 and verse 7. Go then. Eat your bread in happiness and drink your wine with a cheerful heart, for the Lord has already approved your works. Let your clothes be white all the time, and let not the oil be lacking from your head. Enjoy life with the woman whom you love all the days of your fleeting life, which he has given you under the sun, for this is your reward in life and in your toil in which you have labored under the sun. This isn't the only passage that says that. That pops up regularly in Ecclesiastes. You know, life seems futile and fleeting, and all of the things that we might pursue end up being vanity. So when you have those moments to enjoy, take advantage of them and enjoy them. Remember that what ultimately matters in this life is not some trivial pursuit, but is God himself. But notice there the language of describing enjoyment in life. He goes to the grape. He goes to the vineyard. Psalm 104, I've read this psalm in most of our lessons about creation. Because if you're looking for a beautiful psalm about creation that covers just about everything, Psalm 104 is going to be your go-to. But Psalm 104, in verse 14, talking about what God has brought about in his creation as a blessing. He says, he causes the grass to grow for the cattle, the vegetation for the labor of man, so that he brings forth food from the earth and wine which makes man's heart glad, so that he makes his face glisten with oil and food which sustains his heart. But notice there the language of a blessing mankind. You have oil, you have food, you have the grape. And again, the grape is this a very common image. I'm just picking a small smattering of verses here, but hopefully you're getting the idea that it pops up a lot. When the children of Israel are, you can read through the minor prophets, you'll see the same thing. In the glorious messianic age, one of the descriptions of it at the end of the book of Amos is that your hills are flowing with grapes and new wine, and that the press is full of new wine. And so like, you have the language here of when God is fully blessing his people, there's a sign of it that you can look out your window and see, and it's a vineyard. People can misuse that, and when it's not there, it might be a wake-up call that people aren't obeying God. But the grape is often an indicator of your relationship with God in the land of Israel. I want to look at a couple of verses now before we close that have some interesting things to say about the grape. We're going to focus on these passages, not just immediately move from them. But one of them is in Isaiah chapter 5. I love this parable that begins Isaiah chapter 5. And it is a parable that pictures God as the one who owns the vineyard and the vine dresser. And he's the one who meticulously prepares a land to have a good and fruitful, productive, tasty, delightful vineyard in it. And it requires a lot of work to do. So Isaiah chapter 5 in verse 1 says, "Let me sing now for my beloved, a song of my beloved concerning his vineyard. My well-beloved had a vineyard on a fertile hill. He dug it all around. He removed its stones and planted it with the choicest vine. He built a tower in the middle of it and has also hewn out a wine vat in it. And he expected it to produce good grapes, but it produced only worthless ones." So there's this field and it's rocky and it doesn't have anything that would be productive for a vineyard, but he gets all the rocks, he digs a wine vat, he builds a tower, he puts the best vines you can possibly put in that field, right? And he's thinking, after all of this, this should produce some very good grapes. And then he looks at the grapes, but it's only producing worthless ones. Verse 3, "And now, O inhabitants of Jerusalem and men of Judah, judge between me and my vineyard. What more was there to do for my vineyard that I have not done in it? Why, when I expected it to produce good grapes, did it produce worthless ones?" He's like, what else could you do for this vineyard? I did everything to make it a good, productive, fruitful vineyard. What's the parable about? The parable is Israel is this vineyard. And God has freed them from slavery. He's given them the promised land. He's given them his laws. He has taught them how to live faithfully and productively in the land. He's given them all of this. And when he looks to see what they're producing, what are they producing? Nothing good. He expected there to be beauty and goodness and justice and righteousness in the land. He told them how to live justly and righteously. He demonstrated justice and righteousness. But when he looks at them, what does he see? When you look at verse 7, you'll actually get what he sees. He says, "For the vineyard of the Lord of hosts is the house of Israel." That's the meaning of the parable. The vineyard that produced worthless grapes was the house of Israel, and the men of Judah, his delightful plant. Thus, he looked for justice. That's the good grape he expected. He looked for justice, but behold, bloodshed. He looked for righteousness, but behold, a cry of distress. Now, it's actually interesting. If you're reading that in Hebrew, the word justice and bloodshed and the word righteousness and cry of distress, in English, they don't sound at all alike, but in Hebrew, they sound almost identical. And that's kind of the point of it. It's a play on words that's taking place there, where he's looking for justice and he sees something that maybe if you're at a distance and you're looking, you think, oh, what a nice vineyard. But when you actually go and look at it, you realize these grapes are useless. This is the exact opposite of what he wanted out of this vineyard. And that's what Israel was producing. And the imagery there is that Israel itself, in a time of punishment, has become an unproductive vineyard. Keep that imagery in your mind of him preparing the land, building the, digging the vat and building the tower. Keep it in your head and turn with me to Mark chapter 12. Mark chapter 12. This is a parable that Jesus tells. And it says, This is right, by the way, after Jesus has just cleansed the temple and the fig tree. He cursed the fig tree so that it withered, and that's kind of a sign of what's going to happen to the temple. The temple was supposed to be producing fruit, but it wasn't. And so now Jesus is going to tell a parable about a vineyard. Notice verse 1. It says, "And he began to speak to them in parables. He said, 'A man,'" and then notice these words, "'planted a vineyard and put a wall around it and dug a vat under the wine press and built a tower.'" All of those words that you just read come from the Septuagint, translates the Greek translation of the Old Testament of Isaiah 5 that we just read. So this is a direct, really quick summary of that parable of Isaiah 5. He's using all the same language. Someone builds a vineyard like that. But then something changes in this. This parable is not the exact same. It starts with the same imagery, then it shifts. And it says, "And he rented it out to vine growers and went on a journey. At the harvest time, he sent a slave to the vine growers in order to receive some of the produce of the vineyard from the vine growers. And they took the slave and they beat him and they sent him away empty-handed. Again, he sent another slave and they wounded him in the head and treated him shamefully. So again, he sent another, and that one they killed. And so with many others, beating and killing others, and he had one more to send, a beloved son." That's an important phrase right there in Mark, a beloved son. "And he sent him last of all to them, saying, 'They will respect my son.' But the vine growers said to one another, 'This is the heir. Come, let us kill him, and the inheritance will be ours.' And so they took him and killed him and threw him out of the vineyard. So what will the owner of the vineyard do? He will come and destroy the vine growers and will give the vineyard to others." And then he cites a scripture. But in this parable, it begins the same way as the parable in Isaiah about Israel being unproductive. But notice what Jesus does here is he switches the meaning of the parable and he adds some new characters to it. Now the vine dresser, which is still God, the one who made the vineyard is God in both parables. But in the vineyard is Israel in both parables. But now there are these people who are working the land while the owner of the vineyard is away. And the difference is in Isaiah, the vineyard was not producing the right grapes. Here, Jesus says the vineyard actually is producing the right grapes. Like the vineyard is productive, yet there is something stopping that production from getting to the one who owns it. And this is a condemnation not of Israel, but of the particular leaders of Israel who are keeping the produce of the vineyard to themselves rather than giving it back to God. And so in Mark 12, this isn't a condemnation of Israel itself. This is a condemnation of the leaders. In fact, when you get to verse 12, it says, "And they were seeking to seize him, yet they feared the people, for they understood that he spoke the parable against them." So that's one of the important switches that Jesus makes in this parable is he makes it from a condemnation of Israel's behavior to a condemnation of the leaders of Israel. Because Jesus, when he looks at Israel, he sees fields white for harvest. He sees a tremendous amount of good that can be done and so much opportunity. But the leadership has gotten in the way, and the leadership is ultimately who's going to have Jesus crucified. But notice that all of that teaching and that imagery comes from the image of God being the one who owns the vineyard. Like the vineyard is this key image of the ministry of God with his people throughout time. And in this one, it's a retelling of all the prophets that he sent to try to have a good productive vineyard. And they killed the prophets. But the vineyard is a key setting for telling the story of Israel. One other passage I wanted to look at is the one that I mentioned at the beginning in John 15. So turn with me to John 15, and this is where Jesus describes himself, the final I am statement, where he says, "I am the true vine." Now, there are a lot of vines, but that word true is what distinguishes Jesus from all others. All other vines you see are only shadows and images of what the true vine is. The true vine is Jesus, and why is that important? Well, let's keep reading. He says, "I am the true vine, and my Father is the vine dresser." That image of God being a vine dresser, you see it in Isaiah 5, you see it in Mark 12, and in Matthew 22. Like, that's a common image of God's relationship to his people. He is the vine dresser. But Jesus, in this one, says that he is the vine. And every branch in me that does not bear fruit, the vine dresser, God, takes away. And every branch that bears fruit, he prunes it so that it will bear more fruit. You are already clean because of the word that I have spoken to you. Abide in me and I in you, as the branch cannot bear fruit of itself unless it abides in the vine, so neither can you unless you abide in me. So he's telling his disciples, basically, think about a vine. What happens if you like cut the branch off of it? Are there grapes going to grow on that thing? No, that they only have life and productivity if they're connected to the vine. He says, it's the same way with you and me. Like, there are so many things that we can get involved in that end up becoming lifeless if they're not connected to Jesus. Jesus is what infuses all of our ministries with life. Jesus is what, I mean, the church without Jesus is nothing. The Bible without Jesus, it has no power or efficacy. Like, Jesus is what makes all that we are and all that we do matter. Jesus is why scriptures matters. Jesus is why the church matters. Jesus is why baptism matters. Jesus is why the Lord's Supper matters. Like, it all stems from and has life because it's connected to him. And so, verse 5, he says, I am the vine, you are the branches. He who abides in me and I in him, he bears much fruit, for apart from me, he can do nothing. If anyone does not abide in me, he is thrown away as a branch and dries up, and they gather them and they cast them into the fire and they are burned. So in this parable, and he goes on to continue talking about the idea of abiding in him, but the idea is life is seen through the vine of the vineyard. Grapes only come because of the life that's coming from the vine. The branches only sprout and they only grow and they cover the fence because of the vine. And the vine for all that we do is Christ himself. The vineyard becomes a really important image of staying connected to Jesus himself. What should we think as we go throughout life? As we see vineyards, as we see grapes, as we go to the store and we see grapes, as we see grape juice on the shelf, as we take of the Lord's Supper, as we, what images perhaps should this conjure up in our head? Well, one thing that I would say from the get-go is caution. There are good things that God has made that can be misused. And the vineyard and the grape is one of those things. And you can find a good number of stories of misuse and abuse of something that should be a very good thing. But then also, I think you can see those things and remember joy. God has created good things in this world to be shared and enjoyed, and they are blessings for his people. And the vineyard is a great reminder of the blessings of God for his people. That's what Jesus does at the wedding feast of Cana of Galilee. That's what's promised to the children of Israel when they obey God. Rich and tremendous blessings seen in the vineyard. I would also say to remember bearing fruit for God. Work in the kingdom, like in the parable in Isaiah 5. It's like, as we do the will of God, we're supposed to be producing fruit. We're supposed to be producing justice and righteousness in the world around us. We're supposed to be producing good things on behalf of God. And I would also say, remember Christ and life. Grapes wither and die without a vine in the same way that we wither without Christ. So stay connected to the true vine. He's the one who infuses life into all that we do, especially as a church and as a congregation of God's people. Make sure all that we do goes back to him and honors him and is connected to him. And if you want the life that Christ offers, it is still available here and now. And if there's anyone here who would like to become a Christian, would like to have the eternal life that Jesus is offering you, would like to have your sins washed away, please let that be known. You can come sit on the front row while we stand and as we sing.